Hello, and welcome to Out West, the official podcast of the Western Governors Association. I'm Colorado Governor Jared Polis. Over the past year, as chair of the Western Governors Association, I led the Heat Beneath Our Feet initiative, which examined the various market, technology, and policy factors that can help impact and improve the deployment of geothermal technologies. As we move towards true energy independence, the environmental benefits of geothermal energy generation could help position the American West for further economic, environmental, and quality of life success. The United States accounts for about a quarter of the world's installed geothermal energy capacity, and the vast majority of that, 95%, is located in our western states. Geothermal energy holds the potential to create jobs, provide reliable, secure, domestic energy all year round, day and night. Consumers also benefit from direct applications of geothermal technology for heating and cooling. In fact, geothermal heat pumps save 25 to 50% energy costs over conventional heating and cooling systems. Factors such as available geothermal resources, differing energy policy landscapes, permitting, workforce, and emerging technologies were all taken into account when compiling the exciting initiative report, which outlines the recommendations to aggressively scale up geothermal technologies across the West. In today's episode of Out West, we discuss some of the exciting advances in geothermal energy with experts from the National Renewable Energies Laboratory, the Utah Forge Laboratory, CERC Energy, Ormat Technologies, and more. We'll also take a deeper look at the recommendations contained in the Heat Beneath Our Feet initiative report and discuss how they can be implemented across the country.
Thank you, Governor. My name is Jack Spina. I'm the Director of Communications here at WGA. I'm excited to dive into these interviews. To kick things off, I spoke with Amanda Kolker, the Laboratory Program Manager for Geothermal at the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, about the potential to use geothermal energy for heating and cooling purposes. Amanda, thank you for taking the time to talk with us today. I know you have a lot going on in your laboratory these days. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're working on at NREL?
Yeah, so within the geothermal program, we have three pillars of our research. The first pillar is in technologies. The second is market acceleration. And the third is grid integration. So let me step through those a little bit. When we talk about geothermal technologies, we're actually talking about a vast spectrum of different things. So at NREL, we look at geothermal energy as a triple resource. On one hand, it's a source of thermal energy that can sometimes be converted into electrical energy when and where resources are adequate. It's also a storage resource. So you can do great types of thermal exchange in the subsurface. You can store chemicals in the subsurface. You can store mechanical energy in the subsurface. All of those can be coupled with thermal energy storage. And then the third piece is that geothermal is a resource for minerals, because the brines that we typically use for geothermal heat extraction can have critical minerals such as lithium in them. So what we're doing in the technologies pillar of our research is we're breaking these into components, right? So for power, we're looking at emerging technologies such as EGS, closed loop, you know, new ways to produce power from geothermal resources that expand the geographic footprint of geothermal. We're also looking at conventional technologies, optimization of those, optimization of conventional operations. And then on the heat side, we're looking at two different types of systems. We're looking at direct use systems, and we're looking at geothermal heat pumps. And we can talk more about what the difference is there later. And then on the surface side, we're working really closely with our buildings researchers on how to best distribute thermal energy once it comes up to the surface as well. And then we're also looking at things like, can we repurpose oil and gas wells for geothermal? We're looking at, can we repurpose oil and gas drilling technology for geothermal, because drilling is so important. And then in the storage side, we're looking real hard at thermal energy storage in the subsurface. So that's the sort of breaking apart piece. And then we put them all back together and we look at the integrated energy systems that result from weaving together these geothermal heating and cooling and geothermal power and lithium extraction, maybe food production, and what that means for communities and for grids. So that's the technologies pillar. And then on the market acceleration pillar, I would say that a lot of our research right now centers around the various markets for geothermal coming from not just the electrical grid and utilities, but also from communities, even individual buildings. Also in market acceleration, we're working on workforce analysis and workforce development. So how can geothermal help with the transition of the oil and gas workforce, for example, to a clean energy future? And we're doing a lot of stakeholder engagement as well to help accelerate market uptake of all geothermal technologies. And then the last pillar, grid integration. Right now, we're exploring the benefits and impacts to the grid. not just for the power generation, but also how does using geothermal heating and cooling then impact the grid in the sense that you are reducing the amount of capacity that's needed for future grids?
Throughout Governor Polis's Heat Beneath Our Feet initiative, which included a workshop at NREL, we heard about the potential to use geothermally heated water for sustainably heating and cooling buildings. Can you briefly explain how the various kinds of geothermal heating and cooling systems work and the benefits that they provide?
Absolutely. So there's two buckets of geothermal heating and cooling. The first is what we call direct use or heat extraction approach. It's an older technology. In fact, it's been around since the end of 19th century. Well, it's been used in the U.S. since the end of 19th century. Actually, there's reports back to Roman times of it being used. So this is a case where you have hot water, either, you know, underground or in the case of the Romans, actually bubbling up at the surface and using it directly for heating. So you send it around in a district of interconnected pipes and you can heat buildings, you can heat greenhouses, you can use it for low temperature industrial processes. This is kind of an old school technology. It's still used a lot. We have about 23 systems like this in the U.S. There's, I think, over 300 in Europe. And those are typically called district heating systems. And then the other type of technology is geothermal heat pumps. And that's a little more modern technology. And those can be used for individual buildings or individual applications like pools, or they can be used for districts. I would say worldwide, there's a lot of use of geothermal heat pumps for districts in the U.S. It seems like it's mostly a technology that's deployed for individual buildings. Not quite sure why that is, but we're working to change that because we really think that using geothermal heat pumps for either networks or districts of buildings has a lot of benefits. Geothermal direct use, that older kind, really requires reservoirs of thermal water of some type that you can tap relatively close to the subsurface, and that just doesn't exist everywhere. Geothermal heat pumps can, in theory, be used in most places. There are very few places where they can't be used. And geothermal heat pumps are also called ground source heat pumps. And those really just rely on the constant temperature of the earth and about, you know, 50, 55 degree F to either provide heating in the summer or cooling in the winter using heat pump technology. And if we can improve drilling economics and technology to be able to drill to tens of kilometers, then in theory, it's actually available everywhere because the earth gets hotter with death.
During one of our workshops, you noted that the electrification movement would require significant capacity expansion and could impact grid stability. You thought that ground source heat pumps could reduce the needed build out and increase grid stability. Will Tor, the executive director of the Colorado Energy Office, said something similar during one of the initiative webinars, which can be viewed on WGA's YouTube page, by the way. Can you expand upon this a little bit?
Sure. And I'm really mostly quoting others here, grid modeling, because not my areas of expertise. But I will say that what I hear a lot and makes a lot of sense to me is that fully electrified future using conventional technologies will have a lot of requirements for the grid. And it might have some incredible peaks in the summer and in the winter. District heating and cooling networks offer real efficiency into this system. And basically, they would smooth out these summer peaks or winter peaks. What that means then is less capacity build out, which means less siting, less new plants, less transmission, all that stuff. And it means a more stable electrical grid.
Is there a possibility to combine heating and cooling with electricity generation?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, in the U.S., we don't do this very much, but most of the countries that use geothermal power, the water that comes off the back end of power plants is still hot. And then they use what's called cascaded use, where they cascade that hot water to other applications. You start with, a greenhouse or some kind of industrial process, and then you move on to heating buildings. You might take that brine and extract minerals from it before you reinject it into the ground. There was even a couple systems where they were looking at hydrogen production. So yes, that is absolutely something that community scale should be considered more in the U.S.
An earlier episode of Out West explored the potential of repurposing abandoned oil and gas wells for geothermal development. Could these abandoned wells be converted to produce geothermally heated water for climate control?
Yeah, I love that question. It's a tough one. There's some challenges and then there's a lot of opportunity there. So the challenge is that oil and gas wells are smaller diameter than geothermal wells. So the amount of flow of hot water you can get out of your oil and gas wells, provided you do have hot water in them, is lower. The other limitation is that a lot of oil and gas wells don't really have super hot water. We used to say we want water at about 150 C. Now that's dropped back. We can produce power from water with temperatures as low as 90 C or even lower if we have really cold ambient conditions, atmospheric conditions that would allow for cold heat sink. So that's the challenge. The opportunity, though, is that there's millions of these wells. In Colorado alone, we have hundreds of thousands. Only a fraction of those hundreds of thousands are actually producing, right? A very small fraction. I think it's like 31% last year or something like that. So even if we were to get a tiny fraction of those wells to generate geothermal heat and or power, that would still be something, right? And what's neat is that a lot of times, especially in Colorado, there is some kind of thermal demand close by, and there's certainly an electrical demand close by. So that is where we're seeing a bunch of interest. And we are doing a bunch of research projects on exactly how much heat or how much power can get out of a specific well field.
Well, Amanda, that's all we have time for today. But thank you so much for joining us on the podcast, as well as all of the support NRO provided during the Heat Beneath Our Feet initiative. Next up, we talked with Dr. Joseph Moore and Dr. John McLennan from the Utah Forge Laboratory about the exciting prospect of developing enhanced geothermal systems.
All right. I'm sitting here in the control center at the Utah Forge Lab, a field-scale laboratory where tools for creating an enhanced geothermal reservoir can be de-risked and tested. I'm here with Dr. Joseph Moore, the lab's managing principal investigator, and Dr. John McLennan, a professor in chemical engineering at the University of Utah, and the co-principal investigator of the project. Dr. Moore, I'm going to start with you. Can you briefly introduce yourself to our listeners and explain what an enhanced geothermal system is?
Absolutely. Geothermal systems extract heat from hot rocks and hot water at depth. Natural geothermal systems have three components. They have a source of heat, which can be just the earth itself. The deeper we go, the hotter it gets. They have water, which allows us to extract the heat from the rocks as the water passes through the hot rocks. And they have fractures, which allows the water to move from depth to the surface. So we recognize these systems as hot spring systems. Now, we know that there is a tremendous amount of heat within the earth. In fact, it's inexhaustible heat. It turns out if we extracted even just 2% of that heat, say between about 2 and 4 miles, we would have more than 2,000 times the amount of energy used in the U.S. on a yearly basis. Enhanced geothermal systems lack the fractures, and therefore they lack the water that is required to bring that heat to the surface. The purpose of Utah Forge is to be able to create these enhanced geothermal reservoirs that contain fractures which water can be circulated through and then pumped toward the surface and used either for electricity or for building. There are a number of advantages to doing that. One is transmission. Anytime we need to transmit electrons across the country, we need transmission lines, and they don't exist in most parts of the country. Building transmission lines is extremely expensive. That it's time consuming, and extensive permitting has to be done before they can be built. So imagine, if you will, creating a geothermal reservoir where we need it and avoiding the cost of transmission lines.
And so ideally, you could build an enhanced geothermal system anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, we know that temperatures will increase somewhere around 21 to 25 degrees C per kilometer. So we can calculate how deep we need to be just in the mid-continent.
Wow. So why hasn't this been done before? And why are you guys on the cutting edge of this here? I guess I'll turn to you, Dr. McLellan.
People have been trying to do it since the middle 1970s. The original concept was called hot dry rock. The Los Alamos Scientific Laboratory tried the original experiment, which was the analog to enhanced geothermal systems. Unfortunately, at that time, they were not able to establish an effective connection between wells. Since that time, it's been tried in many places around the world, in Japan, in Australia, in Europe, and it never really produced commercial quantities of electricity. You know, maybe a megawatt here, a megawatt there. Now, what changed this was adaptation of oil field technology, directional drilling, and isolation and staging hydraulic fractures. And this has opened the potential for directionally drilling wells, hydraulically fracturing between these wells to create an effective large surface area that fluid can flow through to transfer heat. So the technology has evolved since those early times, but it's been 50 years in the making.
I'd like to make one comment, because some of your astute listeners will say, all you're doing is fracking. You're going to create the huge earthquakes. This is going to be a problem. We don't want to see it in my backyard. And I think that's a fair question, but I think it deserves a response. We are using similar techniques to create the permeability, create the fractures in the rock. So in shale or oil and gas systems, we create fractures, we drain the rock. Those techniques are quite similar, but we have no gas. These are granites. They have no hydrocarbon gases. These don't have any hydrogen sulfide. And the water that we're dealing with is almost drinkable if it didn't contain some toxic metals and elements that it extracts from the rocks. But then there's a big difference. When we use the water, we inject the water. That water then will be produced and re-injected. So we are expecting no large loss of water, and the water is reused. In fact, in all geothermal systems, the water is recirculated, repeated. In the oil and gas side, water is a byproduct, and that water cannot be reused. That water has to be taken to a permitted injection site. And ultimately, that injection site may become filled, and that can cause faults and fractures, a gap, to slip. We get earthquakes. And so this process is quite different. We reuse the water, whereas in the gas industry, it's rejected, and that will limit seismicity.
So where are we at right now with this, and how do we get this to commercial scale?
We are already seeing commercialization of enhanced geothermal systems. In fact, Fervo is one company that has demonstrated commercial amounts of electricity in their Nevada project. But one of the big issues that we face is at higher temperatures, say above 200 degrees Celsius or 400 degrees Fahrenheit, typical oil and gas tools don't work well. And so there's a requirement to develop new tools. Obviously, the hotter we can go, the more energy we can produce. But one of the critical goals of Utah Forge is to de-risk tools that are needed for developing these systems.
We were looking at some of the bits earlier today on site. It seems like that technology has sped up pretty quick.
Well, within the geothermal community, it's sped up pretty quick. Those bits have been used in the oil and gas industry for a couple of decades.
Okay.
But at least at this site, we found substantial increases in the rate of penetration using bits that are made of industrial diamonds.
So U.S. Department of Energy's enhanced geothermal shot seeks to reduce the cost of developing an enhanced geothermal system to $45 per megawatt hour. How confident are you that this can be done? And if accomplished, can you provide some sort of context about how you think that can alter the country's current energy portfolio?
If we look at the current situation in the U.S., we currently, through these hot spring systems, produce 3,700 megawatts. It's not a small ask to go from 3,700 to 90,000, but I think it's feasible. We've been drilling since 2016, and it's now 2023. We have increased the rate of penetration by more than 50% now. 50% of a project is drilling, and 50% is the physical facilities, turbine generators. By increasing the rate of penetration, we probably cut the cost of drilling by 20%.
Wow.
That is a big difference when you're drilling wells that are typically in the 5 million plus range. Dr. McClellan was the first to actually case geothermal wells through the production zone. We were the first to actually perforate through the casing and then into the rock. These are all critical steps to engineering geothermal systems. And so even though we're not producing electricity at this point, we have made major strides in the development of enhanced geothermal systems.
Thank you guys again so much for the time. We really appreciate it. And again, thank you guys for joining us on webinars and just all of your support throughout Keep Beneath Our Feet initiative.
Thank you.
To learn more about the potential for extracting lithium and other critical minerals from geothermal wells, I spoke with Nick Gumman, the CEO of Circ Energy. Nick, thank you for being with us today.
My pleasure.
So Circ Energy took over the operations of a geothermal power plant in the Imperial Valley of California last year. The brine that the plant uses to generate power was found to have high concentration of manganese, zinc, and lithium, so much so that people have begun calling the Imperial Valley Lithium Valley. I know a lot of the process for extracting these minerals from geothermal brines is proprietary information right now, but can you briefly describe to us how it works?
Sure. And just further to your point, we own and operate the geothermal plant. A separate company, Energy Source Minerals, is going to be extracting initially lithium from brine that we provide them. So we're not the developer. This is in part why I'm free to speak about it. We don't have any of the confidential information or secret sauce, but we're an upfront observer and absolutely supporting really all three parties in the Salton Sea, because we feel like this is a tremendous opportunity to manufacture lithium and other minerals in the U.S. and in California and in a place where we're already extracting those minerals. So in short, we produce brine and steam from deep below the Salton Sea to make electricity. Unlike other parts of the world where geothermal power is generated, the geothermal power here comes with an added cost, which is cleaning up the steam and the brine to make it clean enough to go through a turbine. So we're already trying to get most of the minerals and everything else extracted out. We do it in a sort of gross bulk form, and it goes into filter cake and gets disposed of. What Cal Energy, Energy Source Minerals, and Control Thermal Resources, the three developers right now trying to crack the nut of lithium extraction, are doing is trying to pull just lithium out of the brine and make it commercially available in the United States from that manufacturing source in California.
Interesting. And so when you guys are pulling the lithium out right now, what's happening to it?
Well, we're pulling all the solids out, and we're not splitting off lithium, zinc, manganese, calcium, or anything else. It just stays bulk, and it goes ultimately into a filter cake and gets disposed of. After we've pulled the heat out, all of the brine gets re-injected back into the ground in our injection wells. We have a picture of the periodic table on our control room office wall, and we like to say that's today's brine supply. And so we pull out brine and steam that's full of everything imaginable. We mostly clean that up and put cleaner steam and brine into the power plant, and then everything else gets re-injected back into the ground. The challenge is, can you define a process where you can pull out just lithium, extract it, make it commercial grade and available here in America? Because typically, lithium is mined in surface mines that are pretty environmentally damaging. They use a ton of water and they just have a lot of issues. So given that we're already pulling this lithium out of the ground to make renewable energy, it's a natural to see if there's not a way to extract the lithium.
So how much water does this process use?
Sure. So our geothermal plant down there uses anywhere between 1,500 and 2,000 acre feet of water a year. And that is primarily for our cooling tower. And we lose that through evaporation. Most of the brine that's coming out of the ground is going back into the ground. And that's true across all of our geothermal projects. My understanding is that all three developers have different technologies. And again, we're not privy to the, you know, the details of how those work, but just looking at filings and plans that have been publicly announced, yeah, these lithium extraction plants will use 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 acre feet of water a year. I want to say that's on a magnitude of about 1/10 to 1/20 of what the water consumption use is for lithium extraction elsewhere in South America and Asia. And again, that's primarily because the vehicle for bringing the lithium out of the ground are the geothermal wells that we've already drilled. And it's coming out of the ground naturally in steam and brine that's under pressure. And so really the water is just in the treatment and the manufacturing portion of the project.
So we've known that these minerals have existed in geothermal brines for decades. What's happening to change people's minds?
I think it's a combination of market and technology. Going back in time, almost 20 years, Cal Energy did try to develop a zinc extraction facility at the Salton Sea. That project ultimately was abandoned for both economic reasons and also engineering reasons. And fast forward to today, I think some of the technology we have to pull this out has advanced, and really the three developers would need to speak to that. But the market's advanced a lot too. The demand specifically for lithium today, with the drive to electrify the vehicle fleet in the U.S., has really created a strong market incentive. We've seen lithium prices extremely volatile in 2022, ranging from $10,000 a ton all the way up to, I think, $86,000 a ton on world markets. So there's a huge drive right now to find lithium to make batteries for these vehicles. And the Salton Sea estimates are roughly 600,000 tons a year of extractable lithium. So that would have a material impact on the markets. I think what your opinion is on how quickly we're going to expedite the electrification of our vehicles will impact what that market needs to be. But have no illusion. If this is successful in the Salton Sea, we will be manufacturing the lion's share, I think, of the batteries we need to for the electrification of our vehicle fleet here in the U.S. with homegrown lithium.
One of the other major hurdles we've heard throughout this initiative was the cost of drilling geothermal wells.
Sure.
Process make geothermal energy generation more financially attainable.
Well, absolutely, because there's another revenue stream, right? Yeah. So we're going to drill, just to give you an example, two wells this summer, one in Utah to about 7,000 feet for plus or minus $5 million. We're also going to drill a well at the Salton Sea, in part to support this lithium project. That will be over $35 million. Same depth, same diameter, similar sort of rig. Why so expensive? Because we have to line these wells. The casing has to be either titanium or Inconel. The pipelines have to be as well. And really, again, it's all about how complex this brine is with all the various elements in there that can be very costed and corrode and erode pipelines and the like. So yeah, development of geothermal, especially in the Salton Sea, is super expensive. Having another revenue stream or several, if we can figure out a way to pull out not just lithium, but manganese, zinc, and some of these other minerals, will drive down the cost of geothermal in the Salton Sea significantly.
Are there other places around the world or around the West in particular that are seeing similar types of brine or at least brines with the potential to pull out critical minerals?
Sadly for us, our plant in the Salton Sea is the only one in our fleet that has commercially recoverable lithium. And I think that's largely true about most geothermal plants in the U.S. The three main areas for geothermal energy production in the U.S. are the Salton Sea, the geysers in Northern California, and then what we call the Basin and Range. Let's just call that everything else. Mostly Northern Nevada, but Utah, New Mexico, we're looking in the Northwest. I'm not aware of lithium deposits like we see in the Salton Sea in any of those other locations. So we'll have to see. I have read that in Europe and the UK, they're assessing lithium potential in their deep wells there. Same in Germany. So we'll have to see if some of these other places, but here in the US, the focus is definitely on the Salton Sea.
Okay. So how far away is the geothermal industry from making this process a reality and producing commercial grade critical minerals?
Yeah, I think Energy Source Minerals, the project we're most familiar with, is moving rapidly. I think they're hoping to bring their project online in the next couple of years. I'm less familiar with the schedules for CTR and Berkshire or Cal Energy, but everybody's pushing really hard. The market is open. It's there today. There's a huge motivation. We're seeing lots of interest in the financial markets and investing in this. So I think it's really going to be getting over the hurdle of doing something new, both from a technological or an engineering perspective, but also from a regulatory perspective. So they're going to have to jump through all sorts of hurdles to get these projects permitted and get their water rights and everything else. But there's a lot of support, a lot of interest, and we're certainly part of that crowd that's supporting and cheering them on.
That leads perfectly into my next question, which is, what sort of support can the government provide to help speed this process up and bring this to fruition?
Well, as always, the permitting cycle, especially when you're doing something new, can be an impediment if it just drags out too long. So I'm not intimate, and nor am I suggesting they're having specific permitting challenges, but I just know the regulatory environment to get a project like that permitted can be a challenge. And I would think that the government could play a role in making sure that permitting timelines are appropriate, you know, that we're not missing anything, but we're also not defaulting to slow things down based on historical precedent. Financially, I know the Department of Energy under the IRA has made both grants and loans available for this kind of technology. And I'm sure all three entities will be pursuing that as well. And that's super important. While on the one hand, we're seeing a lot of interest from automakers and from oil and gas that's looking to pivot into clean energy to support this, I think having a financial backstop, whether it's a loan guarantee or grants, will be extremely helpful as well. It'll just sort of make it easier for private money to make the investment here.
Mm-hmm. I always like to end interviews asking you, did I miss anything? Anything that you think is important to this issue that we haven't touched on yet?
I just really want to commend Governor Polis and the WGA in general for their support of geothermal. And Polis absolutely stepped up and hit the ball out of the park. So the entire industry is noticed and is supportive, and it's good for us.
Thank you, Nick. Before we get back to Governor Polis for a discussion on the recommendations laid out in the Heat Beneath Our Feet initiative report, we'll hear from Paul Thompson, the Vice President of Business Development at Ormat Technologies, about the benefits of geothermally generated electricity. Paul, thank you for joining us today. To start, can you tell us a little bit about your background and the work you're doing at Ormat these days?
By way of background, I've been with Ormat over a 17-year period. And I say that unusually because I left Ormat for a little bit to work for the state of Nevada. I was Governor Sandoval's energy advisor and then also chairman of the Public Utilities Commission. I chose to come back to Ormat because coming out of the regulatory space, I saw an incredibly bright future for geothermal. I started at Ormat as our executive director of government affairs, and today I'm the vice president of business development in the Americas, and business has never been better. In addition to new technological advances, we have signed more power purchase agreements in the last few years. We've seen regulatory constructs change. We've seen a lot of companies try to come in and look at enhanced geothermal systems, closed loop systems, using some of the IRA money from the federal government. And so it's just an incredibly exciting time to be working in geothermal.
We spoke with Dr. Moore from the Utah Forge Laboratory about enhanced geothermal systems. We talked with Amanda Kolker at NREL about heating and cooling systems. And we talked with Nick Goodman from CERC Energy about the potential to extract lithium and other critical minerals from geothermal brines. What I wanted to talk with you today about is electricity generation. We've known about the potential for geothermal electricity generation for decades, but in recent years, geothermal has received a lot of attention. What do you think is driving this increased attention?
So it's a great question, Jack. You know, I think it is kind of a continued technological advance of the industry. For decades, people thought of geothermal as kind of a baseload resource, meaning it had to produce a certain amount of power every day. And they kind of envisioned some of the older technology with a huge steam plume going into the air and turning a big steam turbine. Over the last 20, 30 years, we've seen the implementation of binary technology. That's where we take this geothermal fluid, we heat a secondary working fluid, it vaporizes, builds pressure, turns a turbine. And the power plants of today look as different as a car looks today than a car of the 1950s. And utilities who for decades were chasing, you know, natural gas generation or maybe a little bit of solar here and there for renewable portfolio standards started having real pressures put on their system. With these new geothermal power plants, they were able to provide benefits to the grid that utilities just hadn't really thought about. It's a capacity resource, meaning we can be there 24/7. We can also ramp up and down faster than a combined cycle gas plant. We're carbon free, and there's really no other resource that meet that standard. The final, I think, issue was a lot of public utilities commissions hadn't seen geothermal proposals in decades. And part of Geothermal Rising effort, Western Governors and Ormat, was to look at a lot of the modeling software for the regulatory work to say, if you take a megawatt of geothermal in their modeling software, it replaced 3 to 4 megawatts of solar with integrated storage. And when they started seeing that data, it became infinitely more valuable to them to say, wait a minute, 100 megawatts of geothermal replaces 400 to 500 megawatts of solar with integrated storage. The footprint on the ground is 22 times smaller. It can provide this capacity carbon-free resource. And all of that took time, but the story has spread. And now I tell people, 5 years ago, we were desperate looking for power purchase agreements. Today, I have probably 5 to 6 emails coming in looking for additional geothermal assets that we don't have because we've contracted everything that was in a huge pipeline of projects to develop. So we are contracting out now for projects in 2033, which is a good problem to have. And we're trying to now say, how do we scale up? Like a lot of the Heat Beneath Our Feet report looked at is how do we get more geothermal resources in development quicker? And that is a good place to be at.
That's a perfect segue to the next question. One of the things that we heard throughout the initiative about the hurdles to develop a geothermal reservoir is simply finding one. Can you walk us through the process of doing so?
Sure. So simply put, we send out our geologists. They take their tuning fork and do studies of the water and try to figure out where is this geothermal reservoir at a shallow or economic depth to develop, and then start the permitting process. In the Western United States, most of the lands are held by the federal government, and that requires a comprehensive permitting program. To get the permits to drill, exploration drilling for geothermal takes about 24 months. To get a permit to build an actual power plant on it takes another 24 months. So if everything goes well, it's a 5 to 6 year development timeframe. Let me give you a comparable. If I was a lithium company, I could stake a claim, and with a 15-day notice to BLM, I can do a push-pull drilling exercise to determine if there are minerals in that area, thanks to the mining law that's on the books. And so what we've been trying to do is say, we need to allow developers to explore quicker so they can know if it's worth spending the money to find a geothermal resource and go through that long permitting process. Because what we're really asking people to do is spend 2 or 3 years and a couple million dollars for the right to go explore. And that is seriously hamstrung the industry. We have a lot of work going on with a categorical exclusion at the federal level to say, if you have a small enough diameter well, let's let you drill like a mining company and determine if the resource is there. Then we will go into the full NEPA process.
Once you know a geothermal reservoir is sort of commercial grade and you've gotten the permits, what does it take to get that power plant up and running from there? And how difficult is it to scale? I know the Puna Geothermal Venture in Hawaii, which is operated by Ormat, is looking to expand. Would it be possible for this system to be the main source of energy for the Big Island? And what would it take to get there?
Great question. I'll take it in a couple parts. We always say we can't fool Mother Nature. We do not bring the fuel supply to the power plant. We bring the power plant to the fuel supply. And so people say, I want to build a 100 megawatt power plant. I'm going to crank the flow and I'm going to make it work. You can't do that. If we try to move too much fluid too quickly through the rocks, it doesn't have time to fully heat back up again. So we tend to take an incremental approach. Let's start with the North Valley example. We had drilled that. We found the reservoir. We thought the reservoir was quite prolific. But before we invest another $150 million in a new power plant, we need to be very confident that the reservoir can maintain that. So we do an incremental step off to say, okay, we're going to drill some more wells. We want to then build another 25 megawatt power plant like North Valley. We're going to operate North Valley for a period of time, make sure there's no cooling, that we've got the resource where we want it, and then figure out if we want to build the next North Valley or, you know, the Paul Thompson power plant nearby. So it's not the building of the power plant that's the limitation. It's your confidence in that geothermal reservoir. Puna, luckily, is located on a volcanic structure that has kind of an infinite amount of heat. We've operated the Puna Geothermal Venture at about 38 megawatts for decades. And we said, look, if we replace a 30-year-old power plant with a new one, we tend to see about a 20% efficiency gain today with the same heat design from the geothermal fluid. We want to replace the equipment on the surface. We want to continue to drill a couple new wells, and we think we can get that facility up to 46 megawatts and keep it operating. Could you do another Puna Geothermal Venture probably along there? Absolutely. The East Rift comes from the Kilauea volcano, and it's a really good heat source.
Throughout the initiative, we heard that some of the main benefits of geothermal power, as you spoke about earlier, were the ability to provide baseload power, but also the cost effectiveness of geothermal electricity generation. Can you provide us with some real-world examples from some of Ormat's power plants?
So if you take the best pricing you can find for solar and integrated storage, let's keep the math easy for me, but let's call it 2 cents. And you multiply that by 4, you get to 8 cents or $80 a megawatt hour. And geothermal projects have long signed contracts below that rate. Simply put, now you're looking at a resource that it's like Costco math, I guess, you know. Of course, you would take the thing that stops you from having to buy, you know, 4 or 5 times as much, is carbon free, provides capacity, and saves you from overbuilding other technologies. The other thing we're seeing in certain states like California is that capacity value. So when we sell energy, there's kind of 3 pieces to it. The energy, the capacity or reliability, the, you know, availability of that resource to always be there for you, and the renewable energy credit or portfolio energy credit, some people call it. What we've seen in pricing is the capacity, especially carbon-free capacity, has become incredibly valuable, so much so that the CPUC, the California Public Utilities Commission, said we need to procure 1,000 megawatts of these types of resources to help us balance the grid. So when we look at the Western Interconnect and what the Western governors are looking at, when you look at building a really sound grid in the Western U.S., all roads lead back to geothermal on the electricity side.
One of the things we heard throughout the initiative was the lack of maintenance these power plants require. Can you, again, give us some real-world examples? What does it take to maintain one of these plants?
It's a great question, Jack. I had a local county commissioner once tell me he absolutely loved our power plant because it was like a little ATM in the desert. And what he meant by that was, you know, they had brought in a Walmart and they had thousands of employees and they had to work on the roads and build a new fire department and more police department and build out the school. And there was a huge infrastructure cost for that. A new binary power plant today, we can run remotely with almost no staff whatsoever. We will send out teams to do, you know, manual checks on gauges and valves. For our Western operations, we probably have 40 or 50 employees to man these power plants once they're up and operating. So the tax burden on them is very high. In Nevada, for example, they pay property and sales tax, they pay the net proceeds and mines tax, they pay mining tax, the list goes on and on. So they really are, I think, the jewels of renewable development moving forward.
One of the things I was really interested to learn about as we were doing these different workshops as part of the initiative was the potential for geothermal electricity generation to decarbonize industry or sustainably power other decarbonizing industries like hydrogen production or carbon capture. How far off is this from becoming a reality?
Not far off at all. It's actually happened. I think the first direct air capture project in Iceland was built on the Heljarskaja geothermal power plant because it is a energy intensive process and you need an energy source that is reliable, high capacity, zero emissions, no carbon geothermal. We have received many comments from folks looking at grants and working with the federal government to say, can I tear off one of your power plants or can we build a new one to do this? So it's here. And I think we're going to be looking at more resources. If we're not selling to electric utilities, we're going to be talking to industry. And we have a lot of commercial and industrial today that want to be carbon free, you know, the Amazons and the Googles. So they're already inquiring about this direct energy resource. But then there's also the direct air capture. Hydrogen electrolysis is also very energy intensive. In Kona, when we had excess power at the plant, we would send it to them to conduct tests at university there for electrolysis. There's not a lot of magic. I mean, we're just producing electricity, but that carbon-free electricity can be used for all of these initiatives and start to decarbonize everything else out there. It just goes back to the beginning of this, which is we have to find more and more resources quickly. We have to be able to permit them and get them to market as fast as possible.
Paul, I always like to end interviews asking, is there anything I missed? Anything that you'd like to add before we part ways?
I can't thank Governor Polis enough for the Heat Beneath Our Feet initiative. I think it was timely for Western governors to look at this. So I think as we move on, the report that came out is going to just be incredibly useful for the Western states. And then I think it tiers nicely into the next initiative that is reducing carbon in some of our processes today.
Well, with that, Paul, thank you so much for your time. It's always a pleasure talking to you, and thank you for being such a big part of our initiative.
Thanks so much, Jack. Talk to you soon.
For the final segment of this episode of Out West, it's my honor to introduce Colorado Governor Jared Polis. Over the past year, as chair of the Western Governors Association, Governor Polis led a rigorous stakeholder process to generate the bipartisan policy recommendations outlined in the Heat Beneath Our Feet initiative report. The interviews on today's episode were just a taste of the in-depth discussions that Governor Polis oversaw at the 4 workshops, 6 tours, and 7 webinars of the initiative. But as with all WGA policy initiatives, the formulation of policy recommendations is just the start. Now the hard work of implementation begins. Governor Polis, thank you for joining us on Out West. The world has known about geothermal resources for thousands of years, but its potential as an energy resource has been largely ignored. What inspired you to focus your WGA chair initiative on this topic?
First of all, the tremendous opportunity we have with the geophysical resources of the West, the fact that we have some of the best heat beneath our feet, subsurface heat in the entire country and world, right in the American West, coupled with our innovative spirit, the desire to establish true energy independence, geothermal electric energy can really be that firm power source we need to make sure that the lights are on year-round, even on the cloudy, windless days.
You hosted tours of the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, the Forge Utah Lab, and Colorado Mesa University during the initiative. Are there a few moments that stick out in your mind as being particularly eye-opening?
The Heat Beneath Our Feet initiative was really exciting. Whether it was touring Colorado Mesa University and learning that with 70% of their building heating and cooling, soon to be 100% from passive geothermal, it enables them to knock 2% off their student tuitions because they don't have those same utility bills that other universities have. In Utah, looking at the cutting-edge technology at Forge, applying some of the deep drilling technology that's been developed for other sectors to tapping this renewable energy source is really exciting.
Earlier in the podcast, we heard from Amanda Kolker, the laboratory program manager for geothermal at NREL, about the critical role that ground source heat pumps could play in stabilizing the electrical grid as we deploy more and more intermittent renewables like wind and solar. You signed a bill earlier this year to provide tax breaks for those who install geothermal heating and cooling systems. How has that been received so far? And what is the path to reaching a larger scale with ground source heat pump technology?
There is a lot of excitement around the tax breaks we provided for geothermal heating and cooling. And we're seeing it lead to a lot of innovation coming to Colorado. And really, to maximize the impact, we wanted to make sure we helped kickstart larger scale projects and with community-wide, city-wide. And the response so far from stakeholders and industry has been overwhelmingly positive, and we look forward to a lot of these projects coming online over the next couple of years.
That leads right into the next question perfectly. As governor, you've already led the way on several pieces of legislation to expand geothermal energy use in Colorado. As you look at the recommendations outlined in the initiative report, is there anything you think you could implement in your final term as governor that would help further expand geothermal energy use?
Well, with geo-exchange networks with thousands of buildings, hundreds of megawatts of electrical capacity being developed, we are looking forward to assembling a state geothermal conference to really work on accelerating deployment of this sector and chart the path forward, expediting permitting reform, creating a gathering space to facilitate a networking and learning and exploration, identifying any additional state policy levers that we can change to help unleash the geothermal revolution here in Colorado and across the West.
Mm-hmm. Currently, there are no geothermal plants in Colorado. Is that something your administration is looking into? And what in this report can you and your team, along with other states, lean on to help in that process?
I'm excited that we now expedited geothermal permitting through our Carbon Management Commission, so we have a quick route to get the deep permitting that we need, developing and deploying geothermal networks. And I'm very optimistic that part of that clean, firm solution for Colorado as we get to 80% renewable energy for our grid by 2030, 100% renewable energy by 2040, you're going to see significant geothermal electric resources come online here in Colorado and across the West.
I was particularly interested in learning about the potential to reuse abandoned oil and gas wells for geothermal energy production. What are the opportunities here in Colorado to do so? And what can states do to help advance these kinds of projects?
Not only are there opportunities to reuse abandoned oil and gas wells, but a lot of the technology that's been developed and deployed across much of the West Energy Central for horizontal drilling, drilling in different types of density of rock layers, a lot of that is applicable to geothermals as well. So both existing and new wells, with existing wells, it's really a question of where they are, what are the temperature differentials, can they be utilized as well as new as well. We're very excited to leverage off of the traditional Western advantage in energy to help make sure that we continue to accelerate our leadership in geothermal.
Mm-hmm. The Heat Beneath Our Feet initiative perfectly aligned with some big funding announcements from the federal government, as well as the Colorado legislature, that will likely help spur geothermal development. How do Western states ensure this kind of support continues long into the future?
It's an exciting opportunity to leverage what we're doing with the Inflation Reduction Act work, the work being done at Department of Energy around geothermal, as well as look at the opportunity for states like Colorado to step up and provide additional tax reductions for geothermal. So I think Western states looking both fiscally as well as policy drivers to help accelerate geothermal development can help establish energy independence for our country, reduce energy costs, and provide reliable energy on the grid.
So after everything you've learned, all the experts you've talked to over the past year, where do you think geothermal energy will be in 10 years? How about 100 years?
I think geothermal energy will be a significantly larger part of our overall energy mix over the next 10 years. The exciting thing about geothermal is once it's online, it can produce for decades or even centuries. And so it's a very stable, ongoing energy source. And once we build these resources, it's likely many of them are even going to be here 100 years from now.
Governor Polis, thank you so much. We really enjoyed you leading us through this initiative.
Thank you. I encourage everybody to check out the Heat Beneath Your Feet report.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Out West, presented by the Western Governors Association. To read the Heat Beneath Our Feet initiative report, please visit westgov.org. And be sure to join us next time on Out West as we continue to discuss critical issues facing the Western United States. Finally, WGA would like to thank Dr. Joseph Moore, Dr. John McClellan, Amanda Kolker, Nick Goodman, and Paul Thompson for sharing their expertise, as well as the Heat Beneath Our Feet initiative sponsors, Oxy, BP, Chevron, Clearpath, Circ Energy, Tri-State Generation and Transmission, Western Governors University, Xcel Energy, Deloitte, Halliburton, and Ormat Technologies. Happy trails, everyone.